Okay, a couple of bits of administrivia. I'm, as you can hear, either coming down with the start of allergy season or I've caught my baby's cold. In the latter case, I will not be in possibly tomorrow or the next day, I don't know. I'll see how it goes tonight, and I will send a note to the list if that's the way it's going to go. However, I'm also due for minor surgery on Thursday, which has me out Thursday and Friday. What this means to you is, if you haven't yet sent me a public key, now is the time. Because if I do end up being knocked out tonight, I'm not going to get back to the keyboard until at least this weekend, and I will be on serious drugs when I do, and you don't want me installing your public key under those conditions. So, and you know, some people who didn't sign up on the list for an account, you know, I'm still getting public keys in. I got two this morning. I'm happy to install them, but please get them in for your sake. Because the only place where we will accept assignments is on CS418. If you don't have a public key there, putting it there will be difficult. All right. Every year I say to myself, yeah, boy, I forgot to do it again. And every year I say, this will be the year that I'll remember to rotate the disk in the file system discussion so that they come in the right order. And here we are again. So I'm going to slightly rotate the topics of this week and next week because the discussion of file system makes a lot more sense if we've done a discussion of disk drives first. Before I dive into that, questions on this lab allocator. The test program is now online as of a few minutes ago on CS418. Yeah?
On one of the debug things, you want us to return a slab header, but you never define exactly what you want in the slab header.
Right. I think if you look at the interface, what you'll discover is it actually wants back a pointer to the slab header.
Yeah.
Right? And there's another piece of the interface that asks you to iterate over the slabs.
Okay.
That pointer is going to be passed back to you. We don't care what the header structure is. We want you to be able to recognize your own data structures.
Okay.
Okay? You had a question?
Is
any
material going to be on
tests? Is any what material going to be on
tests? Disks and file systems.
No. Disks and file systems are off limits for the midterm. The other thing that I'm going to send out, I hope, before I collapse, is sample questions for the midterm. But if I do not manage to get to that, let me tell you where you can find them. If you go back into the archives of the mailing list for last year, right about March, I want to say March 7th, but right around there, I sent out a list of sample midterm questions and just questions from the textbook. So if I do go down before I manage to send those out, that's where to find them. And I was just going to send out the same list again this year. Other question? Yeah, that was a good one. Thank you.
So did you say are the questions from the book, is that like a practice comment?
I'm sorry?
Are questions from the book good practice comment?
Yes. As a general rule, yes. The pattern on my, more on my final exam than on my midterms, is most of the questions will just be stuff that could have appeared as questions in the book. And there will be one or two questions that are actually looking to see if you've done the reading. And not only have done the reading, but have actually put some work into processing the papers so that you understand them. The other thing you should know is that grading matter, I do not reward guessing. I've had exams come back or midterms come back where people will adopt the strategy, well, I don't really know the answer to the question. Let me skew everything I know that's vaguely relevant. And there are two problems with that. One is it deprives you of time to do the rest of the midterm in the exam where you might actually get useful points. And the second is I take that as proof that you don't know the answer and grade accordingly. So it's one thing if you're sort of close and you're not quite sure how to express it and you're sort of, you know, in the right area and there are a couple of things that you're saying, hey, somewhere in here. But every year there's somebody who just views everything broadly on a topic and the answer is they didn't know. And surprisingly often, something that would have helped them narrow the search given their answer, something that would have helped them narrow what to do was right there in the question. I would say that there are two big sources of failure on midterms and exams in general, and certainly on mine. One is, number one is, people don't read the questions. And number two is, yeah, sometimes you don't know. Okay, you don't know, don't waste time on it, move on. Because that's gonna affect everybody. Okay. I've also had people say they felt that the midterms and the exams were hard, and so they get sort of point distributions on the grades back that they're not necessarily accustomed to seeing. Okay, what I want to tell you going in is don't panic, because everybody's experiencing that. And what we've actually found is, yes, you know, if you were to scale a thing on a 1 to 100 or a 0 to 100 or whatever kind of basis, you would discover scores in the 70s, and Hopkins students are not accustomed to that. Okay? But you got to understand that on a test where the scores are in the 70s, the high score is going to be an 80. Okay? So don't panic. Part of what's going on there is I don't tend to give a lot of credit. It is likely Svarup will grade this exam. He's very partial credit happy, so that could make things better this year. But look, the point is don't panic. As I said, I think at the beginning of the semester, you can earn an F in this course, but you have to work at it. Not doing the reading, yeah, that qualifies as working at it. All right. Other questions on that topic or on the project? Oh, one thing Svarup asked me to clarify, and I may or may not remember to send a note, so let me get it out. There is a place in the interface where it asks you, given a slab header, to iterate over the slab, and it says, I'll pass you an index, and I want you to tell me some information about the slab. Something that should have been said in the header, and it's one of these things where after you've been programming in C long enough, it seems obvious that it must be this way, but of course it's not. The question is, so what's the first slab numbered, 0 or 1? Okay. The answer is, if we ask for the slab whose index is 0, that should be the first one. 1 is the second one. Everything in C programs is indexed from 0. And if this were a compiler course, we could do a long digression about why that actually makes sense. Okay, disk drives. So, history here, I muttered in the first class session about how delightful punch cards were. I don't remember if I actually mentioned washing machines in the first drum stores. Did I actually do that? So, punch cards are such a pain in the neck that people were in other domains were inventing things like wire recorders. And it occurred to somebody that if you took the wire and flattened it into something that was, you know, tape-like and wrapped it around the drum, that you could essentially put a magnet next to it that would magnetize and demagnetize it, and if the drum rotated at a predictable speed, that would mean that you could get to particular locations on the drum reasonably quickly, certainly much faster than a wire recorder drive would spin, and a lot faster than getting the operator to put the cards back in the input bin. So in order to do this, as the drum is rotating, at least in the early design, you need some kind of a marker saying, here's the start. Because otherwise it just looks like you have an infinite surface. So you have some kind of a physical marker, and this would later go away in the early versions, a physical marker. Typically it's a hole punched in the drum. Okay. And the magnet or some other mechanical mechanism is able to detect when this hole goes by, and that's how it knows when it's looking at the start of that strip of tape. And there's several strips of tape going around the drum. So, in this kind of design, you have a rotational delay. When you go to fetch something, you have to wait for it to spin around on the drum. Any of you who stood in a laundromat watching your clothes go around understand exactly what this is about. And if you haven't, I recommend doing it because you obviously need to do laundry. The drum didn't last very long. And the drum didn't last very long because it frankly wasn't very flexible. Although, in some ways, it was more flexible. Well, that's getting ahead of myself. Sooner or later, something replaced the drum. Somebody said, what we should do, we need more storage capacity. And there are two ways we can get it. One is that we can shrink the surface area that corresponds to a bit. or on the tape. You can make the magnet smaller. Okay? And that's been done steadily. And we seem to have hit limits on that in about the last year or two. And you now are seeing recording techniques where you're getting multiple bits vertically. Sorry. If this is the, getting way ahead of myself here, if this is the surface of media on a disk drive, we're now in the last 2 years seeing research experiments that actually record multiple bits by recording at different depths in the surface at the same location. Because we've, at a certain point, if you shrink the magnetic spot too small, it becomes very hard to read it with any kind of reliability, and very hard to manipulate it, because remember, this surface is moving pretty fast. Well, the second option, other than shrinking to bits, is to notice that you actually have three dimensions to work with, namely the dimension from the edge of the drum towards the spindle. And if instead of wrapping tapes around the drum, you put them on platters, okay, which I'm terrible at drawing, something like this, then you can make the following modification to the design. Instead of having a magnet that sits on the side and sort of aims this way, you rotate the magnet so that it floats over the surface of the disk. Okay, and you put multiple disks potentially on a spindle, although the first one's only had one. And in fact, as this idea would progress, what happened was that you ended up with a design initially where you had an actuator on the side, and the actuator moves in and out. Okay? And attached to the actuator are disk heads. And there's one disk head on each side of a platter. So now the situation is, when I want to go to a location of the disk, I have to describe three things. Which platter do I want? How far in and out do I want to go? That's known as the cylinder to start with. And which sector do I want? The sector is, if I find that start location as the thing is spinning, the sector is the unit of storage. So on the early drive, sectors were, I think actually 256 bytes on the earliest drives. But nowadays you'll see them with 5, 12, or 1 kilobyte sector sizes. And so the sector number says, how many from the start, as I'm rotating, after I've gotten to the right place, how many do I want to skip before I get to the sector I'm after?
Wait, is data stored on the disk in concentric circles, or is it stored in like a spiral?
Not stored on a spiral. That would be a phonograph record. Or for those of you too young to remember phonograph records, that would be an audio DVD, an audio CD. In fact, one of the big fights when the CD specification was being laid down was whether they would use a spiral tracking mechanism or a concentric ring mechanism. And it was incredibly stupid that they ended up with a spiral tracking mechanism. It made the mechanism of the CD drive infinitely more complicated. It was basically a digital media whose physical format was dictated by analog concerns. It was brilliant. DVDs aren't that way. DVDs are concentric rings. If you take this platter and just sort of invert it so you can see the surface of it, so here's the outermost ring of data. And what I'm drawing in here are the sector numbers. Okay. So, and let me emphasize, these are the physical sector numbers, and I'm going to explain why I'm emphasizing that in just a second. And there's a law of nature that says you never get a convenient number of sectors. It'll always turn out to be some bizarre number that's not a power of two. At least on the early drives, there's a problem with numbering sectors in the simple, obvious way that I've drawn. The problem is, I'm sorry, let me do one more thing before I do that. So there's a bunch of rings, and I'm going to draw a little gap here because I want some room for numbering, but imagine that this ring was adjacent to the outer ring. Okay, I just want a place to put numbers around it. And I'm attempting, and you're now learning why I did not go to art school, to draw this in such a way that if we were to connect the sector boundaries, right, each of them would be sort of a spoke. Right? So all the sector ends line up. So this is actually supposed to be here, and that's supposed to be there. Okay. First thing to go. Alright, so what are the sources of the lead? I apologize. I'm really coming down with a cold. I'm usually much more organized about this one. First thing is the head has to move in and out. Okay? That's this entire actuator. Right? It's a mechanical mechanism inside the drum. And the very latest research stuff is working on devices called MEMS, right? I forget what the, it's micro electromechanical something.
Systems?
Okay, so what's really cool about those, there is still a mechanical thing going on here, okay? But it's going on at a really, really tiny, tiny scale. And the MEMS devices are going to be much, much faster than disk drives if they can work out the capacity issues. But then basically, the head has to move in and out. So this is not as selecting a cylinder and looking at the picture face on, right? It should be obvious why that is here.
Was there any work ever done instead of having a single head on each platter, having an entire line?
Yes, I'll get there. So the head has to go in and out. You have to pick which platter and which face of which platter you're going to access. And then having done that, you have to pick which sector you want. And the numbers that I've drawn in here in the ring are the sector numbers. At least there's a story about the sector numbers. As we're going to see in a minute, the story is wrong. And just to make life confusing, the old style way of addressing this stuff was you would give a cylinder number, a head number, and a sector number. So you did not actually select a platter. You selected a head. And the heads, generally speaking, were numbered in such a way that 0 and 1 were on the first platter, 2 and 3 were on the second platter on opposite sides. Okay. Now, the first thing to notice is the drive is spinning pretty quickly relative to the processor. You have to remember that when disk drives were invented, processors were still pretty slow. Sufficiently slow that as you would rotate through the drive, you'd say, I'm looking for sector 3, and you'd get it. And you say, oh, I want sector 4 as well. By the time you were actually done processing sector 3, sector 4 was gone. Right? It had rotated out from under you, and now you had to wait for a full other rotation to go around. This is a pain in the neck. So what would you do if you had this problem and you hadn't solved it?
Buffer and the hinting system.
Sorry?
Hinting system and the buffer.
A hinting system? What's a hinting system?
You tell it what you're going to need. Or a cache, which reads ahead.
Memory is terribly expensive in this generation.
Read the next sector anyway, because you might need it.
Okay, you could do multiple sector read. You could certainly do that, and there were, on later drives, there would be some technology to do that, but in the earliest generation of drives, there's no intelligence on the drive.
Add another parameter to that, so 3.5 things or whatever.
Okay, so that's the read multiple sectors idea. What else can you do? Again, that requires some intelligence, because now I've got to figure out when to stop on the fly.
Slow the drive down.
Slow the drive down. Yeah, you could do that, and there actually are places, believe it or not, in computer architecture where that's the right answer. This wasn't one of them. But it's, you know, it's a plausible idea. What else could you do? Wait. Okay. So it turns out the single biggest source of delay in disk drives is the rotational delay, because if you miss, it's the only one you can't negotiate with. You can arrange your data placement on adjacent cylinders. You can arrange your data placement on adjacent heads. Right? You miss the clock for the sector you're after, you're going to wait for a spin. What else could you do?
don't write data sequentially 1 to 2, skip some sort of...
So renumber the sectors. You renumber the sectors. That's exactly what they did. They said, okay, so this is the physical numbering of sectors at the drive level. What we're going to do is we're going to introduce soft sector. Actually, soft sector is something else. We're going to use soft sector numbers. And at the OS level, what we're going to do is we're going to write sector number 1 here, sector number 2 here, 3 here, and we're just going to skip a sector. Now you see why I cleverly used an odd number of sectors. Apparently not so quickly. Okay. So we're just going to write in alternating sectors. And then when the drive spins around again, we'll reuse the gaps. And the reason is to buy us just a little breathing room to process the one sector before we go touching the next one.
Is that
going to
decrease your throughput?
Yes. In theory, it's going to decrease my throughput, but if I can't actually process the data as fast as it's coming in, then the answer is no.
Right.
And the limiting factor here was I couldn't actually handle the flood. Right. It's hard to imagine how slow processors were in this generation. Right. We're accustomed to processors that are 100 times faster than memory. Right. In this generation, memory was faster than processors. And we didn't have smart DNA. So this is something the CPU had to process. Now, the next thing you can do, and this quickly got done, is say, hey, I really don't like having this divot in the drive that tells me where sector 0 is. And that turns out to be completely unnecessary. So if we were to crack open one of these sectors on a modern drive, what we would discover is it's not just data. Right? There is certainly data in there, but there's a preamble, and there's something called a CRC. So a modern drive, the preamble tells you what the sector number is. So when you format and you do a low-level format on a drive, which most of us haven't done in years, because drives now come formatted. When you do a low-level format on a drive, what's actually happening is it's writing the preamble in zeros and a well-defined CRC in every sector. What's a CRC? It's a cyclic redundancy check. It's an error-correcting code.
Correcting or just checking?
Correcting. So the idea, the CRCs that were actually used on the early FM series, on the FM drive, for the earliest floppy drive, FM is the encoding type that was used on the earliest floppies, was actually capable of correcting multiple bits of error. Because the media just wasn't that good. I mean, you literally get the magnetic stuff flaking off the drive. Well, so now what happens is you seek the cylinder and the head that you want, and then you say, where am I? You look down at the drive, and it's spinning past you, and you basically watch the preambles as they go by, and when you find the sector you're looking for, you start actually paying attention. So what you actually, on a modern drive, you actually have a processor that's out at the end of the arm on the latest drives. It's sitting right above the head. Essentially, when you put the head in place, you turn this magnet into scanning mode, looking for the sector that you're after. And then, according to whether it's a read or a write, you may flip its mode to write mode when you find the right sector. And actually, as on a modern tape drive, you can do this with two heads. Okay, so you have a read head and a write head. And the purpose of this is to actually give you enough gap so that when you flip the mode, you can rewrite the entire sector after you write this. On modern drives, this so-called sector skew no longer happens. Modern drives are fast enough to grab the sectors from the other. However, What's the order in which data is written? That's an interesting question. So the historical answer was, you try to write data linearly. Linearly means, whatever is the lowest cost to get to the next sector, that's the one that you should view as the next sector. So obviously, once you get to a cylinder and a head, you're going to write that cylinder. And the model was, you would then go to the next head. So you'd write sector sequentially. When you ran off the end of that cylinder, you'd go to the next head. Sorry, when you ran off the end of that platter, you'd go to the next head. You'd go to the next head. You'd go to the next head. Finally, you'd reach the last head of the cylinder, and you'd go to the next cylinder. Right? And that's what it means to write data linearly on a hard drive. Okay. And the delays here, where are the delays coming from? Well, the rotational delay is actually quite large. Do the arithmetic. If I have a drive that's going at 7,200 RPM, right, which is these days, let me do this one because it's actually 7,200 RPM.
Yeah?
What's that?
120 cycles per second.
Thereabouts, yeah. So if I ask, what's the time to do a rotation? Wait a minute. Guys, this is under 60 seconds, right? So it's, yes. So 1/120th of a second to do a full rotation. That doesn't seem so bad, right? Until I tell you that it's not uncommon to see 1,000 sectors in a cylinder, in a platter, in one of these bands on a drive. Right? So you can see the timing here is getting kind of tight. But 1/120th of a second is what in milliseconds? Somewhere around 10.
8.3.
See why rotation speed's a big deal? That's a long time relative to your CPU speed. All right, what about seek delays? Well, actually, on historical drives, there were two sources of delays. So one was you had to get to the right cylinder. And on the earliest drives, this was accomplished with something called a stepper motor. Okay? The way the stepper motor worked was step, 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 and periodically it would look. Why look? Because the early stepper motors were not 100% accurate. They would occasionally overstep. So the strategy is you would step for a while. In fact, in the earliest drives, you would issue the step commands by hand, and you'd say, where am I? And you would discover occasionally you'd gone too far. So there was something called a seek delay. And on the earliest drive, that was a function of how many tracks you had to go from where you are to where you wanted to get to. Last delay is something called a head settling delay. So once you got the actuator to the right cylinder, you now had to move the correct head into proximity with the drive. We're talking about something where the distance between the drive and the head is measured in millimeters. And you've got a lot of vibration here, right? You've got a spindle going that's got a fair amount of weight on it, considering the speed, and that spindle is vibrating. So you don't try to move these heads while they're in proximity to the drive. You lift them, you move the arm, you lower the head in the drive, you see where you are. So, typically on modern drives, this is in the 1 to 1.5 millisecond range. You get the heads out of the half. The story for sinks has become much more complicated than it used to be. It used to be, hey, number of tracks times seek delay, and that was it. That's no longer the case. It's now the case that the drives are smarter, and what happens on a sink depends on how long a sink you're doing. Going to the track next door, The seat delay is basically the same as the headset delay. Explain why. I told a slight lie. So this picture would have you believe that oftentimes, if you were to draw a vertical through the platters, right, that it would intersect the same track on all platters, right? That there really is a cylinder that you can hypothetically cut out of the platters. That is no longer true. It is now the case that the cylinder widths are so small that cylinders are no longer physically aligned in that way. There's still sort of a logical notion that you have a certain number of cracks on a cylinder, on a platter, but they're not really mechanically aligned anymore. And so on modern drives, if you do a short seam, what happens is it goes over one or two or three tracks over many things you're doing, and it says, where am I? Well, the where am I is done by lowering the head of the drive and looking. So when I say that there's a preamble and encodes what sector you're in, actually it encodes more than that. It encodes the sector and the track and the head. However, here's the interesting part. On a modern drive, if you're going to do a long seek, the drive says, hell with it. I'll figure it out when I get there. Pick the head up, hurl it as hard as I can, you know, something to land somewhere in close proximity to where I want to go. And then I'll figure out where I've got and I will correct locally. This is called a ballistic seek. Literally, it really is called a ballistic seek. So if you, there are now some good papers. One of the things you'll find is, because of ballistic seeks, it is no longer meaningful to quote seek times for drives. People do it largely as a matter of tradition, and if you read the fine print, you actually have to look at the methodology for computing seek times. So if you get a 15 millisecond seek drive, 15 milliseconds is the measure, or now it is 9.5 milliseconds, right, on the fast drive. 9.5 milliseconds is the measure of how long it takes to do a random seek. What is a random seek? Well, you get a big random number generator, you generate a long list of track numbers you'd like to go to, you seek to them in turn, whatever the average seek time is, that's what you report. How many of you have ever observed a computer doing a random seek in the wild? If your computer is doing random seeks, what we know is you're running the disk drive test program. And other than that, you will never see a random seek on a drive, so this is a terrible metric. It's useful as a metric of, as an indicative metric of what are the costs if you mess up in your file system layout. But it's not a useful metric directly with drive speed. The much more important metric is rotation speed. Okay. Because the thing that we can control, when we go to put data on the drive, we can do a pretty good job of getting related data well localized. So if I'm reading a large file, I'm not going to take these ballistic seeks. Right, that's what defragmentation is about. And the numbers are, you can do a pretty good job of avoiding fragmentation until your drive is about 85% full. Somebody used to ask those people with Redmond hard questions about why they need to be fragmented so often. Past 85%, you're just not going to find a well-localized block and you're kind of stuck. That just seems to be how it works out. That's an empirical number. There's no, well, there's probably science behind it, but I don't think anybody's bothered to look it up. Alright, so if I tell you that the average seek delay is 9 milliseconds, that actually tells you approximately nothing. So the rule of thumb is the seek delay is a function of how far you're going, it is no longer a simple function. And without a big long table that gives you the actual point-to-point delays in the drive, you can't get a good answer trying to do computations of delay. So because of that, now that I've told you this story, for the rest of the class, we're going to assume that seek delays are a linear function of the number of tracks that you're going. Or if not, I'll specify exactly what happens in the ballistic decline in such a way that it's reasonably calculated. So, the other thing they're saying is, if I'm writing more than one sector on a modern machine, and I've got enough memory to hold all the sectors that are going out, Once I get to the right place and I start writing, writing more than one block or more than one sector is actually very cheap. So, just as an intuition, imagine I take this average C, this non-existent average C. Let's just sort of do the math on this drop. And I say, hey, I want to write a sector someplace. Where am I glad it's going to be? Well, 9 milliseconds for my non-existent average C, 1.5 milliseconds for my head settle delay. Now, about that rotation, 8.3 milliseconds to rotate. Closer to 14 milliseconds on a 5400 drive, which is what's in most of the laptops. So if I'm looking for a sector, I'm now in the right place. How long am I going to rotate? The intuition. Under what conditions will I pay for the whole rotate? When I just missed the sector on average. Could I get effectively a zero rotate delay?
Yeah.
If I get really lucky, I could land on the sector. Right? Is there any reason to believe that I'm more likely than one or the other? Not without a lot more information than we have. And remember, sinks have errors in them, and so you can't really rely on that in general. So on average, how much per rotate am I likely to do?
Half.
Half. So what about for the second sector? I'll write two sectors sequentially. What am I going to pay for the second?
There's no
sink.
You're going to have to do the head.
Not if I'm on the same track. I might fall off the end of the track, but if I'm still on the same track.
You only need to move one sector.
Right, so what's the marginal delay to move one sector? Well, I haven't told you how many sectors are on the track. Let's proceed on the assumption there are 1024 sectors on the track. Or, just since I'm going to do decimal arithmetic here, let me make that simple and call it 1,000. Yeah.
So the 8.3 milliseconds are 1,000?
Yep. Until I hit end of track. Now, which of these numbers would you rather pay?
Do you really? You're not really looking for the next sector, though, because you've written to that point. The time that it is to rotate to the next sector is you're actually using that time.
What do you mean?
Because you're doing the read or a write on that.
Yes, yes, yes. I'm saying that if I was going to write two sectors, right, there's a cost to write the first sector. In fact, strictly speaking, I have to pay this cost to write the first sector because, of course, I have to actually transfer all the bits, and that takes this amount of time.
That's awesome.
Okay. But the marginal cost to write the second sector, right, is this tiny 0.0083 number. Now, remember, this number depends on the configuration of your drive and how many sectors per track. And some drives have more than others. On modern drives, where the rotations are this high, I want you to think about something a little strange. That the number of sectors on a modern drive, you may have listened to the drive on your laptop, you may have heard it like this, it's actually changing speed. Okay? And the reason it's changing speed is because the bits are packed more tightly on the inner cylinders, and it's therefore harder for the magnet to actually pull them out. So on the inner cylinders, you'll have fewer sectors than on the outer cylinders, and you slow down on the model drive. So the number of sectors per track is not uniform. This old story, in fact, if you go to the BIOS, right, it will probably still let you put in your drive specifications in terms of cylinders, heads, and sectors. That model hasn't been accurate for 25 years. It's a lie. Your drive controller will simulate that behavior, but it has nothing to do with the physical geometry of your drive. Yes?
Wouldn't the devour your laptop batteries if your hard drive kept changing speeds?
Yes, it does. And one of the, laptop drives are slower for two reasons. The big one is heat. But the other one is not wanting to change the kinetic energy of the drive. In terms of, if you look at two sources of battery drain on a laptop, two big sources of battery drain. Number one these days is your display. And number two is your drive. And that's why when you go to the Linux tuning stuff, tuning for laptops, number one, turn off the block flush system so that you're not spinning up your drive all the time. Okay, but the point I want to make here is there is an enormous payoff or penalty according to how well or how badly you linearize your data. If I fall off the end of the track, I'm going to have to pay another head settling delay, but that's only going to happen 1 second in 1,000 in this design. Okay, questions about disrupt?
Since you said that every sector now has a preamble, what do you mean by, what does the term running up into the track mean?
Okay, so preamble or no preamble, the track is still physically only going to hold a certain number of sectors. Right? So if I start at the beginning of the track and I start writing, oh, I should explain. This preamble, I said it was written in the low-level format. When you're writing data, you're only rewriting the data portion, and then the hardware controller is rewriting the CRC for you so that it can determine if there's been a bad sector or a loss of data. Right? When you get back a bad block, what that means is that the controller layer read the data, read the CRC, got a miscompare when it recomputed the CRC, and tells you it doesn't believe the data anymore. In fact, you can't recompare the CRC during a reading. Because you're writing as you go, right? You've got to go around again and read again to make sure, because you couldn't have written the data over bad regions of the platter. You have no way to know that unless you check the result. And so there are there are software disciplines that do what's called read after write. Okay, what they do is they do that, right? And then they let the platter spin around a second time, and they reread the sector that they just wrote in order to check for a miscompare. Because the deal is that sectors going bad after the drive is in production, it's a very rare occurrence, but you need to know where those sectors are. Because the drive actually adapts dynamically, right? So what happens is when the controller says, oh, you know, I noticed there's a bad sector in this track. I have this other track over here that I can tell you about. It's called the spare track. I will put the sector over there. I'll remap the track, generally, to this other region. But it doesn't do that until it observes a bad sector. Right? So when you use MakeFS to make a file system on Linux, or when you're installing a file system, you may have noticed it takes a while. When the Fedora installer does a file system initialization, I'm not sure, but it may be that it takes a while because they're writing zeros to the file system. I don't know if they're actually doing it. One of the reasons you want to write zeros to the file system is not that zeros are great things to have, it's that they provide another initialization, okay, and then you can run around and you can reread the track and learn where the errors are. As a consequence of learning where the errors are, you will force the drive to reallocate the bad tracks, and that's what you want. The alternative is to discover them the hard way. Now, following that, the most likely source of failure on the platter, physical deterioration in the surface, heat prostration. Overheated drive will go south for the winter. can't tell you how pleased I am with my ThinkPad. I made two very expensive drives this way. Okay, but linearizing the data really pays.
What fat sector is because you're not going to kill the linearness?
I'm sorry?
You'll pay a seat delay if you hit
fat
sectors.
Yes, you will pay a seat delay if you go to write a bad sector. So, from the software perspective, you could say, hey, I'll build a map and then I'll just avoid the damn things. On a modern drive, it's not a big deal. You don't actually have that many bad sectors on a drive. You've got enough buffering going on that the drive can, generally speaking, hide that. And it's not going to happen often enough to be worth planning for. Although, be careful, because that buffering means things you thought you wrote to the drive are not actually written to stable storage yet, right? They're sitting in cache, and one of the problems is if your operating system crashes in a disorderly fashion, not to be confused with crashing by virtue of having it shut down on purpose. One of the things it will not do is it will not advise the drive to flush its caches, and if the drive fails to flush caches, your data does not get saved. Okay, the reason I wanted to go through this first, and we'll start on file systems tomorrow, assuming I'm still handling this right, is with this as the underlying set of costs, it'll make sense that the major sets of issues in file system design are about where do I put the data, how do I organize it, and that is how do I get it maximally sequential, and how do I do my data right in such a way that if I get a failure in the middle of an operation, I know what the unit of failure was. There's no way to completely avoid failure. But, for example, imagine that in memory you had some kind of a memory that was battery backed. Okay, just wave your hands around and imagine you had such a thing, and you were going to do a binary tree in this memory. You want to be very careful about your order of pointer updates, because if you manage to set up a pointer to point to a node that hasn't been initialized yet, you haven't got a good binary tree anymore. And if you fail between those two steps, right, well, the battery's going to hold the memory, so the bad pointers are going to come back. But they don't point to anything. So you now have a corrupt data structure. We're going to get into exactly that issue with files. Come back tomorrow.